My grandmother lived with my husband and I for 10 years, and she lived. Her husband was killed in World War II. She lived with her. She lived with her sister soon after that. And so she lived with her sister almost her whole life. And in her mid 70s, her sister died, and my grandmother was highly functional. And after her sister died, things fell apart, and she was unable to manage. And so she came to live with my husband and I for from 1980 to about 1990, and then she fell and broke her hip and ended up, she couldn't do stairs, and she was unable to live with us after that. But Bill's dad died suddenly in 1995. He was 83, very vibrant, just died the way we all want to die, right? He died one night. And but his wife, who was in her 70s, they had never really talked about what would happen, and there was a folder left, what to do when Charlie dies. And so personally, I think that everybody here probably knows personal experiences of people being unprepared for this, and yet it's a natural, inevitable event for all of us. I have to tell you, I was a nurse and a social worker and a geriatric case manager in the hospital, and people would come in constantly, and I was always surprised that they hadn't thought about what's going to happen if, when. People who were unable to provide personal care for themselves, and yet they had no one to care for them. People who were unable to walk steps, yet they had a second floor with only one bathroom upstairs. People who had frequent hospitalizations and their health was deteriorating, and yet they hadn't thought about what they might have wanted. And so I would, again, personally and professionally, this issue kept on coming back to me, and that's really where I became very interested in it. And people with heart problems who haven't thought about whether they want to be resuscitated. And by the way, resuscitation was designed for people who were healthy, to return them to a healthy state of life, not for people with multiple chronic conditions. People who don't think about dialysis despite kidney failure, and dialysis is a whole separate issue. People who don't think about the ventilator, should they end up on one? And people who have underlying respiratory problems could end up on one and may have problems getting off of one. So people who have dementia, who haven't considered whether they want to end up on a feeding tube. You know, the end stage of dementia is you're unable to swallow and eat, and you're mute and unresponsive, and that's absolutely in the trajectory of dementia, and yet people aren't thinking and talking about this. And by the way, we have over a million people on tube feedings in this country. And it's another device that was never intended to be more than short term. So again, all of these issues made it so that I was interested in this topic. Bill, could you give me a... So I would like to talk to you a little bit, overview, and share the importance of this and share my local research. Depending on time, I'm not sure how much I'm going to get into some suggestions and tips for you, but I will be able to provide them for you, at least that you could print them up. And I also just want to say that this may seem to be a negative topic, but it's actually very empowering for people to talk about this and put plans in place. I know the media in the past few years has, and various politicians have used words such as death panels and things like that. But I have to tell you, people should take a proactive role addressing this with their doctors and others. And should it be legislated that doctors address it? I think it should be. I'm sorry that Medicare is not doing it. New York State just put a law in place that all practitioners there must do it. So I'd like to see the states move forward with that. But in the meantime, I'd like to see people take a much more proactive role in it. Next slide. So when I'm talking about advanced care planning, what am I talking about? Well, traditionally, we talk about advanced directives, living wills, which is a treatment directive where you can say what you would want should something happen to you. The next document, which is a little bit better than the living will, is the durable power of attorney for health care, also called the surrogate decision maker form, proxy form, and some in different states call it different things. But this is the form where you can say what you want, but you can also appoint someone to speak on your behalf. Because the problem with the living will and the treatment directive is that people are left to decipher what you meant. You know, people say things like, no extraordinary efforts, or be kept comfortable, and people have problems understanding that. And so appointing someone is really a better thing to do. We know from a famous study that was conducted in the 1980s, the 1990s, it was called the support study. It was over 9,000 patients in over 5 major hospitals. They found very little evidence that people were planning in advance for care, And I have to tell you, that was surprising, because in 1993, the federal government passed the Patient Self-Determination Act, which required all Medicare and Medicaid providers to ask of their adult patients age 18 and older, do you have an advance directive? Would you like to put one in place? Now, many of you may know about that law, because if you go to a healthcare provider, an HMO or a doctor or a hospital, you'll often find in the written material, or someone might even ask you, do you have an advance directive? Would you like to put one in place? They're required to do that by federal law. But it really stops there. It's not done in a way that we believe to be more effective, that we know from the evidence that I'm going to share with you today. We know that addressing it at the time of hospitalization is not the best time. People are ill. They're vulnerable. So it's very difficult to ask people at that time, by the way, you know, who do you want to make decisions for you? Since 1991, when the law was passed, here we are 20 years later, and upwards of about 25% of the population has an advance directive into place. Now, there are regions where that is higher and situations where that's higher. For example, in nursing homes, they address it at higher rates. But overall, it's been largely a failure. People aren't putting it into place, and we'll talk about some of the reasons for that shortly. One of the problems with the documents, all 50 states do have their own documents, but they're all written at a 12th grade level. They should be written at the 9th grade level. They do not include language for same-sex or domestic partners. I have seen many problems with that. There's a lot of variability between the states. Some require them to be notarized. Some are just witnessed. So there's a lot of issues with that. Next slide. What we do know about planning in advance for care, particularly in the health domain, is that it is a process and not a task. It's not just fill out a proxy and then you're done with it. We know that there's much more to it than that. It's a process to decipher your values and your goals to guide everything you want for the rest of your life. So it's not just a task. We know that the underlying principle is autonomy, for people to maintain control. And we know that that's best done in the context of one's relationships. And so it is a social process. It's not just a legal document. And in addition, it addresses multiple domains. It's not just health planning for healthcare, but it's also other areas. Who will care for you socially? How will you manage in your home? So environmental aspects, residential aspects, legal aspects, power of attorney. So there's so much more to it than just end-of-life decision-making. I also want to mention that culturally, we have a very homogenous society here in Sarasota. I 65 and older, 98% Caucasian. I don't know if you knew that. 98% Caucasian, 65 and older, in Sarasota. So we're very homogenous. But I have to tell you, the rest of the country is increasingly multicultural. And there are some cultures that find talking about taboo and planning for end of life very taboo to talk about. There's a work being done now with the Navajo tribe in New Mexico. Well, they were having problems with those Indians, American Indians, doing advance directives because it was against their cultural beliefs. And what they found some progress with is, so they won't do the advance directive, but when they ask them about this poem, this metaphor, when the time comes that my last breath leaves me, I choose to die in peace. And people are signing up for that, but yet they're not filling out the form. So as you can see, the legal focus on the forms doesn't work for everybody. Okay, next slide. This topic is critically important for all Americans, but particularly for older people. It has been fueled by the nation's palliative and end-of-life care movement. And how many of you are familiar with palliative care? You know, palliative care is definitely going to be much more popular in the future. Palliative care is diagnosis-driven and not prognosis-driven the way hospice is. You know how hospice, you have to have a guesstimated of 6 months or less to live? Well, palliative care is diagnosis-driven. So if you get diagnosed with a chronic that could turn into a terminal condition, you are entitled to palliative care consult. And palliative care will focus on all aspects of your life, sort of this multidimensional, not just your health care. Focus on pain management, and again, focus on quality of life. And so there's a growing movement with palliative care, and I did want to just give a plug-in for that. One of the reasons we know that planning in advance for care is important is we know that people who don't do it, there are a lot of adverse outcomes. It leads to medical overtreatment and undertreatment because people don't know what people would have wanted. And so remember, people are sitting there in beds being prodded or being kept in ICU rooms or whatever because others didn't know what they would have wanted to do. And that's a problem. It also places burdens on family members who have to assume the decision-making without the express communication from the people who should be saying what they want. Now, the gold standard is for people to speak for themselves. And then next, for somebody who you've appointed who knows what you want to speak on your behalf. We also know that it causes conflict between family members and between family members and healthcare providers. You know, when someone doesn't say what they want, and you've got four or five children who've got different ideas of what mom should do, and then you've got providers saying what to do, and all the kids are saying different things, providers have very little tolerance for that. They don't like dealing with that. They prefer one decision maker. And that is what the directive does, advanced directives do. It does allow one decision maker to be appointed. Next slide. We do know that people who do put advanced directives into place have increased satisfaction with their plans. They're more comfortable. They have less fear and anxiety about what will happen. They're more optimistic because they've been engaged in conversations, and they actually do put the directives into place more. We also know that there are some real benefits to it, quality of life as well as cost savings. An Archives of Internal Medicine study found that cost in the last week of life were 55% higher for people who did not have advanced directives into place. Terminally ill people with hospice are likely to live longer and have a better quality of life over aggressive treatment. They're less likely to die in the ICU. There's less suffering. And 6 months later, the families are less likely to be depressed. So the ripple benefits to everybody for talking about this and getting it out there and everybody following through are very important. Palliative care has been shown to save about $1,700 per patient in a typical mid-sized hospital, which is over $1 million annually. And the reason why they're able to do that is because they're engaging people, they're keeping people comfortable with pain so that they can continually make decisions for themselves. Next slide, Bill. I'd like to share with you a lot of conceptual overlays to all of this. And I love this quote by Joanne Lenn. The end of life must be understood as a period that spans years, not just weeks or months. You know, a lot of the talk about end-of-life care is focused on the last few days of life. Joanne Lenn is a geriatrician with the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services. And she used to be with the RAND Institute. She looked at death mortality statistics over decades. And I'll share with you her findings in just a moment. But what we know is that we're living longer and longer, and we need to prepare for the rest of our lives. The average life expectancy in the United States, we've added over 30 years since 1900. Today, Americans are living well into their 8th, 9th, and 10th decades of life. The largest growing group is 85 and older, and that group is expanding at the greatest rate. But we also know that the majority of people will ultimately experience declining health as they age. And we know how more and more people are having chronic conditions. Next slide, Bill. Oh, I'm sorry. He forgot to put that slide up. He's sleeping on the job here. I wish this slide was a little bit bigger for you, but this is some of Joanne Lenn's work, this trajectories of decline at the end of life. And what you see here is these are, you know, the population. Most people are pretty healthy, and a subset of people have chronic illness, all kinds of things, diabetes, cancer, emphysema, you know, arthritis, you name, all kinds of chronic diseases, and most of these people are managing just fine in the course of their day-to-day lives, and then a distinct subset of the chronic illness will turn into a fatal illness and terminal stage for many people, and what we know is that right here along the y-axis, this is degrees of functioning, so this is how well people are functioning, and this is the x-axis is over time. And so what we see here is that she has found in her work and looking over mortality statistics over decades that Americans typically follow one of three courses. And this is the end-of-life course for the majority of Americans, 9 out of 10. In the first course, you see long periods of pretty high functioning, okay? And then you'll see a fairly quick drop that will occur, usually with this period here is within a few weeks to about 18 months. Okay, people will go downhill fairly rapidly. This is characteristic of cancer, of advanced of cancer that progresses. And in this trajectory, people will experience long degrees of functioning with a few weeks or months of rapid decline in which the fatal illness will become overwhelming, leading to death. Cancer is the most common cause here, with about 20% of Americans following that course, peaking at about age 65. And so, as I said, death is usually within about 18 months once this decline starts. Now, in the second trajectory, faced by about 25% of all Americans, is exemplified by a slow decline in functional static with an exacerbation of mostly two conditions, congestive heart failure and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, which is emphysema and chronic bronchitis. And so what you see here is people have a reduced functioning capacity to begin with, and then they're going to have an exacerbation of their disease. They're going to go down, maybe be hospitalized, go downhill, never quite return to that degree of functioning. And the end-of-life course for them will be a continual decline with exacerbations of the disease. And again, that's about 25% of all Americans facing that course. After living with years of increasingly poor health, people in this course will experience death rather suddenly, and ultimately die of chronic organ system failure, mostly in their 70s. Now, in the final trajectory, again, here we've got a degree of functioning here, and you see here people are starting very low level of functioning and over a very prolonged period of time continually going downhill. This final trajectory represents about 40% of the life course for Americans, is typified by long-term dwindling of functioning requiring years of personal care. About half of this population will have serious cognitive failure during this course. Death will follow after a minor physiological challenge such as the flu, urinary tract infection, pneumonia, a broken bone, in which the body will be unable to recover, at which previous stages of health in life the body would have easily been able to recover. And combined, these latter two trajectories represent the end-of-life course for two-thirds of all Americans. And just, you know, mentioning this to everybody, I know that when I was first introduced to this, I immediately recognized so many people in all three of these trajectories. And just curiously, do people recognize people that they've seen in this? So this is what we know. And so because we know it, we can plan for it. Next slide. And this is just another recap on what I just showed you. Again, that first trajectory was a fairly rapid decline, about 20%, mostly cancers, peaking around the mid-60s here. You know, the problem in end-of-life care planning with this group is this hits people at what we call an off-time event. People in their 40s, 50s, 60s didn't count on cancer hitting. They weren't ready for it. They're not ready to give up, and by God, the oncologists aren't ready to give up. And so these people, planning in advance, you know, they're still fighting for their lives. And so by the time that it becomes apparent that they're going to succumb to their illness, we've lost a lot of time. And you now are talking with weeks and days for this group. But these other two groups, we do have a lot of time, as you can see, years and years to start thinking about that. And that's really what, it's a very predictable decline. And so I think we can make a lot of difference there. The only problem I want to say down here in this group, again, because about half of them end up with degrees of cognitive impairment, it is important that they be involved early so that they can state what they won't want. People can follow that on their behalf. Next slide, Bill. You know, another conceptual overlay I want to share with you is this concept of planning in advance as yet another health behavior. We know health to be multidimensional. I think we all know that. You know, you ask people how their health is, and, oh, I've got diabetes. Now, people always focus on some sort of physical thing. We all know in this room, and we all know in this world, that health is not just physical, biological, but it's also social, psycho-spiritual, and unfortunately, economics does play a role in people's health as well. This leads to people's health behaviors, which lead to outcomes. And some of the, you know, for example, people who are declining physically, they have a whole bunch of feelings and beliefs about it. We're going to talk about that in a moment. who is available to help them, who are the social resources available for them, what are the economic resources, do they have health insurance, are they covered for that assisted living facility? Well, no, they're not. But are they covered for, you know, whatever service that they're looking for? And so eligibility and all these sorts of things become an issue. And some of the health outcomes, if people were more prepared here, some of the health outcomes could be averted ER visits, quicker transitions between levels of care, decreased length of stay in acute care setting. All of these would lead to cost savings as well as better for people. Next slide, Bill. So just quickly on the domains that we mentioned here, some of the psychological domains. Again, some of the issues here are, how are people coping? What are people's concerns with the illnesses that they're facing? How do they feel about the fact that they may need more care or they may be unable to remain at home? We know that people's personal goals do influence their planning. People overwhelmingly want to maintain their valued life activities. Most people want to remain in their home. So we, in order to do that, we need to engage people in thinking about these things. Next slide, Bill. I think this slide is terribly important because, you know, here's the question that needs to be asked. Who will care for you if you cannot care for yourself? That is a really important question. People don't answer that question. People don't even think about that question. Who will care for you if you cannot care for yourself? What supports are available to you, formal and informal? A lot of people, a lot of this is unspoken. People don't want to be a burden to their children. There are other cases I can tell you. I've worked with people that, God damn it, I took care of those kids, and I don't care what they have to do. They're going to take care of me. So, you know, and this is unspoken familial realities for people. So, you know, we're here to acknowledge that there's differences. And there are cases where, and again, a lot of this is unspoken. There are cases where it's implicit that we haven't explicitly addressed this, but you will care for me because this is what we do in this family. And people are following those roles that are set out for them. And, you know, I want to say I'm not here to tell anybody what they should or shouldn't do. I can tell you that every situation is individual. I don't know if I'm going to get to the slide on families, but, I mean, I will tell you that working with caregivers is terribly important. As a matter of fact, the Family Caregiver Alliance, which is really the best source of information on caregiving for professionals and the lay public, they are now, and they've been doing this for a few years now, they're now calling forth for primary care docs to also interview caregivers about their capacity to continue providing care. You know, when we have people being cared for by family members or by others, it's terribly important to know whether the caregiver is capable of continuing to provide that care. Because after all, if something happens to the caregiver, now you've got two people. And we have seen that on the tail end. And so that's very problematic. And there are times where, you know, maybe the adult daughter has an invalid husband herself or dealing with their own health problems or dealing with some their own childhood, their own children are acting out. So there's a lot of circumstances. Some people aren't able to provide the physical care that some people need. They're just little people and they just can't provide or they don't have the technical abilities to provide. More and more, they're expecting families to pick up more technical care that, you know, decades ago, home health nurse would have been doing it for you. But they're teaching families injections and all kinds of things, infusions, all kinds of things today. So every situation is different. I think that's a big take-home message. Everything's individual. And I will tell you that in the hospital setting, I was always very, very careful not to impose any belief or expectation on families. I remember one story where a woman was really, really distraught because one of the nurses implied, you need to take care of your mother. And this woman had so many problems, and she really was unable to do this. And we're, as healthcare provider, we weren't there to create yet another guilt trip for people. So there are a lot of considerations involved. And, you know, and by the way, there's plenty of people also caring. You know, my grandmother lived with Bill and I for 10 years, and, you know, we would tell you that that was one of the most important experiences of our lives to have her with us. And so for many people, there's nothing more important. But again, it's all individual and the timing is involved. Spiritual needs. Bill, the next slide. sleeping on the job, Bill. Spiritual needs. Look, especially if you're talking to a group like this, you know that people's beliefs about life and health and their future goals and how satisfied they are in their life and their fears and their wishes and their relationships and their living environment and their religious beliefs and their personal sense of independence and self-sufficiency, these are all factors that affect how people cope with these diseases. But yet people don't do a lot of reflection thinking about those things. And it's all very individual. It does, you know, it's very subjective. Christopher Reeves, you all know, remember Christopher Reeves, right? He used to say, I mean, I don't know if I wanted to live like him. He was on a respirator, quadriplegic, right from the neck down. I tell the kids, I don't want to live like that. I said that. He used to say, this is just the physical embodiment of who I am. And so he was able to supersede that. I definitely don't want to live like that, and I've made that clear. And by the way, people can change, but there are, you know, it's entirely subjective. We've seen people, you guys, in the hospital who've been bedbound for 10 years, most happy people you could imagine. I've seen people, if they can't play golf, they don't want to live. So it depends on personally valued bodily functions and a sense of dependence and independence, and people really vary on that. Next slide. Of course, you know, people's medical needs are an issue for ongoing health needs. You know, how are the person going to maintain their health needs? And I'm talking here about, medications, diet, access to medical care, transportation, things like that. Those are all part of this. Also involved in this area is, who will speak for you if you are unable? And by the way, most people will find themselves incapacitated in a hospital setting. You know, the hospitals will all do this differently, but generally, you're all presumed to have capacity to make your own decisions. But medications, lack of oxygen flow to different to the brain and blood flow affecting different body parts can affect your ability to think clearly. The hospitals have different procedures for this, but generally, the attending will determine that you are now without capacity. The hospitals that I worked at usually have had a concurring physician also indicate that the person is without capacity. And that's the point at which a healthcare proxy is now making decisions for you. You know, you never thought that it could happen, but it can change on a dime. And people need to think about this. Physical needs. A big issue here really is safety at home. Again, most people want to remain at home. So can people manage themselves safely at home? Are they able to get through the day? Are they able to cook, shop? Are they driving? Do they need transportation? You know, I'm not here to talk about another big project we're doing in the community right now on promoting dignity and aging with independence. Maybe I'll come back to speak about that. But I have to tell you, people are telling us, I don't know what's going to happen when I can't drive. And that is something that we need to think about to prepare for people now and not after we have many more people who are already, and we already have enough people in that situation. We're going to have records numbers of more people in that situation. Is a person at risk of falling? Are they able to manage their finances? All of these things. Okay, financial needs, Bill. Next one. And I mentioned briefly before, what are the final financial resources available to people? You know, the cost of care is expensive. Transportation, medications. Another thing we keep on hearing from people, the cost of medications. So the serious financial burdens. And so what happens if people cannot afford to do what they would like to do? What's plan B? Okay. Another conceptual overlay I'd like to share with you is this concept of planning by stages of behavior change. Next slide, Bill. And it's, as you can see, it's a continuum here. And pre-contemplation is here, and then contemplation would be here, and then maintenance would be at this end. But basically, people on a range of healthcare decisions are on this continuum from, geez, I haven't even thought about that before. It hasn't even dawned on me. I need to think about planning for my future. I think I've seen something about that, I heard something about that, but I'm not really thinking about it. To preparing, actively looking into it and putting some plans in place. To getting the plans in place. And also, nothing is static, my friends. Everything needs to be dynamically revisited. And so staying on top of that. And again, you know, we see people all the time. Some people like to call this group here denial. How many times have we seen that, right? right? People who are not thinking about yet all the red flags are there. So we're here to share people to move them along in this continuum. I wanted to share with you some of the planning personalities that we have identified out there. Maybe you'll recognize yourself. And you know, it's so unfortunate though, I have to tell you, it's real unfortunate because in a crisis mode, options are limited. I want to tell you, if you're in an acute care setting and you can't return back home, you have now lost the luxury of you selecting where you might want to go and waiting for that wait list to open up, and now utilization is going to be an issue and you'll be forced out. So scramblers, these are people who are forced to act in response to a health crisis. Reluctant consenters, people who are pushed to make a change in arrangements by relatives and professionals who notice that things are there's too much of a decline. Wake-up callers, people who change their arrangements in response to a near crisis while their health deteriorates. And then, of course, there's advanced planners, people who are researching it ahead of time and being prepared. Then others have identified avoiders, people who try not to think about it. Thinkers, people who are aware of it, but they don't make any plans. Planners, people who think about it and do make plans. And consenters, people who just adopt the plans by family members and others. And I have to tell you, that's not what it's all about. It's not about what your children want for you or what the doctor thinks you should do. That's why this is so important. It's about people saying what they want so that everybody can make sure everybody's on the same page and everybody does their best to honor it. Okay. So let me tell you about our study, and we know about all of this. We know about the needs are growing and the importance of planning, and so we wanted to look into what is the prevalence of planning in Sarasota and Manatee County, and out of the people that do plan, what is it about them that's making them plan, and what factors predict people who plan. And so we conducted a study, a survey in Sarasota and Manatee counties, and we used stratified random sampling we identified zip-coded areas in the two counties of high proportions of where older adults live. And if you're wondering what you can determine in a zip code, you can determine a lot in a zip code. We know that there's high proportions of older adults residing in various zip codes in these two counties. And so we did that, and we had the Florida International University, they have an Institute for Public Opinion Research. I went down there and trained them, and they conducted the random telephone, they had operators with the telephone screens up, and phone numbers would come up at random. Well, the sampling that was based on random allows us to generalize these results. You know, I don't think people ask enough about when you see research results about the sample, because, you know, if I sampled people that I ran into at the mall, yeah, I could generalize the findings to the people that I ran into at the mall. But in order for me to generalize these findings to these two counties as a whole, I would have needed to do random sampling procedures. And random sampling is based on the laws of probability that every person had an equal chance, every phone number had an equal chance of coming up. And because of that, we're in a very strong position. We're able to say, from doing this work this way, we're able to say with 95% confidence that these findings would be found over and over again. Put another way, if you pulled 200 older people in Sarasota and Manatee counties, just at random, 200 older people, if you did that over and over and over again, 95 times out of 100, you would find what we found. That's what the benefits of this type of sampling design allowed us. Okay, that's the statistics there. So what did we look at? Just briefly, we looked at, we used these established tools. We wanted to know whether people were planning for help from family and friends, their living arrangement and their housing. We wanted to know whether they were accepting or not accepting of planning ahead. We wanted to know if they were planning for their health and if they were planning for their financial future. Next slide. We also wanted to know who they were planning to get the care from or where they were planning to get their care from. And if you go to the next slide, Bill, well, actually, go back to that one real quickly. So we asked people, what are your plans? We asked them open-ended, what are your plans? But then after they answered us, then we specifically asked about relatives, about friends, about home care, moving in with family, assisted livings. And for each one of them, turn to the next slide, Bill. For each one of those, we ask them to rate for us. Oh, I know, I don't want that. Or, yes, yes, I want that. And then here, with a degree of specificity, yes, I have decided to do this, and I have taken concrete action. You know, it's one thing to say, yeah, I want my family to take care of me. It's another thing to say, yes, my daughter Cindy's going to do it. Right? So we were looking at how concrete people's plans were. Next slide, Bill. Some of the factors that we looked at were people's age, whether they were married, their religion, their living arrangement. These are all things that we know to be associated with people planning for the future. And again, all of this was dependent upon was their attitudes were going to be dependent on these things, whether they put the documents into place. And we also asked about the last will, whether they put that into place as well. Next slide. Just really quickly about our sampling, I apologize, it's hard to see, but people range in age from 65 to 95, and the average age was 77. A little over half were female, most were Caucasian, but again, reflective of our demographics. About half were married, about a third were living alone, over half did not have college, about a quarter were low income, and we also had a range of different religions presented. And we had an interesting finding that we're going to share in a moment. So on our next slide, Bill, what we found is in where people stood on this, basically we found a pretty high agreement that people accepted the need that they had to do it, particularly in the area of health. But in the area of social environmental, the higher number means less agreement. And so people didn't see this as an issue at all. They were a little more likely to plan for health, and they accepted it. But the social environmental, people aren't recognizing that as an important consideration. Okay, next slide. So we asked people, you know, do you have advance directives and a last will? And look what we found here. We found very, very high rates of these documents. I mean, I just shared with you that only about 25% of the population does have these. So we did find very high rates in our two communities, and that's far greater than the national average. This one was very, particularly finding for us, about almost 90%, because 9 out of 10 people in this country die. Excuse me, 7 out of 10 people in this country die without a last will. 7 out of 10. So we found very... Now, remember, that's counting everybody, including people of all ages who maybe didn't count on it happening. So there is some degree of planning there. Here was a really surprising finding for us, and that was only about half of the sample had thought about general plans, and only 1% had concrete plans in place. So it showed us that people are not seriously considering this. Now, people like this slide because we asked people all these, who's going to take care of you? And look at what people wanted and thought was going to happen. Look around to your friends right now. Because most people thought that my friends will help me. And I have to tell you, I think that there's a lot to that, and people are very fortunate enough to have these great social networks, and I think that people are going to be very proactive in informally supporting each other. But I think that there are limits to that, you know, depending on the degree of care needs. I mean, taking someone to the doctors and maybe picking up groceries is one thing, but obviously the more extensive the care becomes, the harder that's going to be. But only 5% of them had found a concrete commitment on that one. It looks like a lot of people did agree that they would ultimately end up in a nursing home, moving with family, which is interesting. These are in descending order here. So people did have general plans for this. And by the way, you know, many times people say, I don't want to live with my children. That's not a good thing. I don't want to be in the same house with them. And in this case, you know, there's a general request here, but very few of them have actually concrete, again, that implicit thing we talked about earlier where it's not really talked about. And again, in descending order, we have, you know, moves to assisted living, remodeling the home. Very few people thinking of these options. Home care is it's going to be a growing area. You know, the home care workers, and I can't remember, I should have looked it up for this group today, but it's just in the next couple of years, that group will number more than the RNs and teachers in this country. That's how big that group is going to be to help people remain at home. Okay, so what did we find? We found that for each additional year, of age, that there was an increased likelihood of putting the advance directives into place, and an increased likelihood of putting concrete plans into place, and an increase in planning for social, environmental, with each increase of years. And we used regression analysis there, and I will just share with you that, if it was 100%, there was no difference between the ages. But, for example, 200% would be twice as much, 50% would be half as likely. And so that's how we have some of our findings. For gender, we found a greater likelihood for females to have, twice as likely, to have concrete plans, more likelihood to plan overall, higher acceptance attitudes toward planning, and actually a little bit better in the planning for finances as well. And we think that's very important because women, being female, is associated with greater long-term care needs. Women are 75% of all nursing home residents and two-thirds of all home care consumers. Here's the finding that I think everybody will find interesting. Among Catholics, we found a decreased likelihood of having concrete plans in place. We found that being Catholic was associated with a decreased likelihood of having a last will and a decreased likelihood in having a living will, one of the advanced directives. And, the researchers, my colleagues and I, we simply get, when you write up these articles for publication, and this is in the Journal of Applied Gerontology, we simply suggested that perhaps people who are Catholic believe that God will provide for them. It needs to be further investigated. Religion was not the key focus of our finding. But I did want to share that with you, though. Living arrangement, we found that for those who were living alone, they had a lower likelihood to plan overall. They had a less planning and higher acceptance of non-planning. They planned less in the finances, less inclined to plan for social and environmental. This is very troubling to us because people who are living alone are also linked to lower income, poorer health, less availability of caregivers. So these people may need more care and they're not doing it. Higher educational status, this one was not terribly surprising. People who had a higher educational status were more likely to have a last will, because of inheritance probably, and also more likely to do financial planning. Regarding health status, we looked at two things here. We looked at self-reported health, and we also looked at the number of chronic conditions. And we found that those with poor, fair health were more likely to have the advanced directives into place, and also, but also a lower likelihood to plan overall. They also were associated with a higher non-acceptance of planning. So, the people who have the greatest need, not planning. Functional status, we were looking at people's ability to care for themselves, personal care needs and instrumental needs, such as being able to cook and shop for yourself and manage your transportation. And those people, a decrease in the likeliness of having a concrete plan. So again, a group that needs this planning most, doing it least. However, interestingly enough, we did find a greater planning among people. We break up functional care from personal care activities, bathing, eating, feeding, transferring from a chair, and instrumental activities such as I said, cooking, shopping, using a phone, managing transportation, managing finances. So the people with those instrumental needs were planning more, but the people with the more serious personal needs were planning less. And we believe that the people with these minor needs, shopping, and those people may be motivated and more realizing what's coming down the road. And so the people with more personal care needs may simply be too overwhelmed with their own care to be doing this. We don't know. I wanted to share with you, I'm not going to be able to share too much about this because in the interest of time, I'll go as far as I can. Really a model for planning, and it's not as rational as it looks. People can pop in. People can pop in at any point. The ideal thing is to assess and reevaluate your needs on a regular basis, and then to identify and involve others in the process, to talk about and think about. People are not very reflective in this country, really thinking about what matters most to them and how they really want to live out their lives, and people need to do that more, getting information and communicating with others. Bill, you can go to the next slide. So People need to assess the planning their needs. So, you know, think about your life. You know your conditions. You know what the future is. Ask information about what the future trajectory of your illness is. And consider your needs in a holistic way, as we just shared. Not just, you know, because the doctor's just going to talk to you about, well, you got 3 more doctor visits. Now, that's what they're going to talk about. We're talking about it. How are you going to cope with it as your condition continues? Who's going to help you? So, again, the complete picture is really where you need to be thinking. This is particularly a problem for people who have, you know, cognitive impairment and may be unable to participate in this. The general rule of thumb is, look, people with mild cognitive impairment and just early stage dementia are generally pretty functioning still and can still make a lot of decisions. And the goal is to honor what they have expressed early on. Now, people moderate and end stage, you're going to lose that ability. But you can still do a lot when people are still, and there's years and years of that, so you still get that. But so can people understand, are they able to, and by the way, all of this is voluntary. That's what autonomy is, that people get to decide this for themselves. And when we talk to people about this, you know, we need to be careful of framing and coercion and persuasiveness. You know, we see children do it, adult children, we see practitioners do it. You've got to be careful of that. It's about what people want. So the point is just to start the dialogue. And by the way, studies show us over and over that people want to talk to their providers about it. And good luck in your 7-minute meeting, whether you're going to get anything out of it. And the chance that it was going to be legislated was blocked. Okay? It was blocked. Identify, involve others in the process. Again, this is important because people don't live in a vacuum. They need to make decisions on the basis of other people's lives and schedules as well. And, you know, we do have a big bias towards family, but there are a lot of circumstances here. I mean, there are adult children, we've seen it, who are emotionally unable, physically unable to do what is needed to be done. And people automatically assume, oh, my daughter, or oh, my son. And so, people sometimes need to think about non-kin as maybe the best person to be the person for you. And, you know, in the hospital setting, when they ask you to appoint a decision maker, you know, they'll come back and collect the form for you. You know, you spend more time at Publix deciding whether you're going to have Cheerios or cornflakes. And you're choosing whether you're going to be a DNR or not in a split second. And really, so think about your priorities on that. It really needs to be really thought through. It really is true. So the best person may not automatically be who you think it might be. It may not be your spouse. Your spouse may be unable to. I have been in setting after setting after setting where things happen and that adult child or spouse who the person believed was able to represent their best interests deferred to the doctor because of the power differential of that relationship and was unable to stand up. You know, Richard Nixon, when he had a stroke, he was allowed to die. Jacqueline Kennedy, Onassis, she was allowed to die. There are families that I can tell you that when the doctor says, oh, well, they had a stroke, should we put a feeding tube in? The person said, I don't want to live with a feeding tube. That is artificial nutrition. The longest person that kept alive with a feeding tube has been over 50 years. Feeding tube is artificial nutrition. Medically, ethically, legally, there is no distinction. You do not need to have, you can remove them, but symbolically, it's very difficult to remove them once they're in because of the symbolism. Medically, ethically, legally, they're perfectly acceptable. They are artificial means to keep you alive. And yet, so once people get on that course, it's harder for families. So involve others in that decision. And some of the issues that we do see there, though, are people who don't want talking with their family members, or the family members are not close, I mean, geographically distant, or dysfunctional families, aren't we all? The HIPAA regulations are a barrier sometimes as well. I don't know if you know the healthcare laws that preclude practitioners from speaking with family members sometimes, but I will tell you that things work out best when everybody knows what, at least they're guided by where do we go. I mean, I've been on ethics committees where we are trying to decipher what people want because it's not clear and because the families are everywhere. Nobody was appointed and the families have different opinions. And it's very problematic. Okay, some family issues. I briefly mentioned these a moment ago, and again, that's people's, you know, the person's role in the family, where people are at in their life cycle. Again, sometimes the person you want to point, or the person you want to be the key person, may not be the right person for a lot of reasons. You know, families work differently together. Again, non-kin is important. I've seen some really great things happen when people have just done things with family who, you know, they're not their biological family members, but they're so close that they could be. And those sometimes work very well. Family emotions are an issue. Family communication structures differ. I've seen families keep a, books by the bedside, and every family member comes in writes so that everybody sees what's going on. I've seen other families, you know, demand to know from the nurse what's going on, although the sibling was just there 5 minutes before that. You know, so all kinds of things. People need to communicate. But people differ in, their sophistication of understanding some of the complexity of their health sometimes, so there's a lot of issues there as well. Okay, the big thing, and coming up near my end here, I think this is the most important thing I want to share with you, is determining your values and goals for the future. Again, it will help people think about what's important. It's often a factor of cultural, religious, spiritual, family considerations, but it has to do with how people are willing to accept care, or it may impact the scheduling and delivering of care. It's shaped by people's life experiences. There are a lot of unspoken issues involved in this, fears, being a burden to others, a sense of abandonment. And again, by doing your own values, ascertaining your own values, you come to terms and these things get brought out and they can be talked about. There's one tool that I want to share called the Values History Form that you can download. And I will make sure that somebody here gets the link for that so that you can see, because it's a really nice tool for you to share with your family members as well. Next slide. Yeah, so just get as much information you can about all kinds of services to remain at home and to live your life the way you want to live it. There's, you know, web resources as well. Not everybody does the internet, but there's all kinds of way to get information. Get multiple perspectives. Communicating with others is really important. One of the problems with the advance directives is sometimes people don't have them with them when they go to the hospital, and then the hospital doesn't know what to do. We are probably going to end up in the state with a physician-ordered life-sustaining treatments called the PULSED form. Other states have done it successfully. Basically, this is the form so that paramedics don't get activated, because if they come out, you're going to the ER. And if you go into the ER, they're going to try to save your life, if that's what you wanted or not. Perhaps you didn't, people see stages of death coming and they overreact, and they, even though everybody agreed that we were going to die at home, a whole bunch of things can ensue, and so there's a whole bunch of things that we can do to make sure that people's needs are honored in the community setting as well. I'm not going to have time to mention this, but this whole PowerPoint is available for being downloaded, but a lot of people have shared with us that there's a lot of people that don't want to talk about this. And my just general suggestions are, you know, use all the natural opportunities to talk about it. We've seen adult children, when the parent wants to say something, "Oh, come on, Mom, nothing's going to happen to you. I don't want to hear that." And so it goes both ways, and there are people that close down on it both ways. But it, as you can see from here today, it is a very important conversation to have, and you'll be better, much greater off by having it. And in the Bill, just go through the these links that are on the PowerPoint. I will make sure I get them to you, but caringinfo.org has got where you can. The advance directives for the state of Florida do not need to be. You do not have to have a lawyer. Don't pay for a lawyer. They just need to be witnessed. Okay? You can get the documents for a variety of sources. Caringinfo.org, you just go to the state of Florida and you can download them. Make sure that they're filled out correctly, though, because they will not be honored unless they are invalid. So I like them. And Compassion and Choices has got a lot of good stuff there as well. I do like the Five Wishes document, but I have to tell you, I don't like it because now they charge $5 for it. And I think that people shouldn't have to pay for it. But they ask questions. It's advanced directive, but they also ask, who do you want to make decisions? What kind of treatment? How comfortable do you want to be? How do you want people to treat you? And I love this part, what you want your loved ones to know. And sometimes it's easier to write that than to say it, but you can do that on a regular directive. You don't need to spend the money on this. Long-term care planning kits, longtermcaregov.org, and I've got the links for these for you. I really like this site because on it you will see, you can estimate the cost. I mean, it's really good. I wish we could Google it here for you. You can actually go in and pick Sarasota and get an estimate of year or multi-year cost on home care, assisted living, and you can see some real numbers that you're looking at. Okay, so I really do like that. The ABA is the American Bar Association. They have some really good stuff on long-term care planning. I like them. Next one, Bill, Medicare has got a planning guide for your long-term care. I like that one as well. Some other helpful resources, the National Institute on Aging has age pages, Getting Your Affairs in Order, and long-term care, Choosing the Right Place. I think those are very helpful. For those of you who travel state to state and... This U.S. Living Will Registry is a good one. You can electronically store your directive so that, you know, if you're in New York but you're in Florida and you have a directive but it's in New York, you know, it was built. Each state should honor each other's states. There really has not been any serious problem with that. But you're really better off having something electronically retrieved if you don't have it with you. This makes it so that providers, they'll give you a little sticker to put on your... Well, you know, as soon as you go to the hospital unconscious, they're going to check for your insurance card. So when they find the insurance card, they see the little sticker, and they know to go to the registry, and they can download through a secure transmission that you've got a directive stored there. I used to like this more because now they charge people. They didn't in the past, and they charged the providers, but they didn't charge the people. And so I don't really like that. But and you are responsible for updating it because if things change and now you don't want to be a DNR or something like that, you need to update it because otherwise what you have in writing last standing is what's going to be followed. The ethical wills, I like this a lot. A lot of the local lawyers are doing this, and some of them are doing it for free. Highly encourage this. This is a way for you to address values and beliefs you want to impart, legacies, spiritual values, hopes and blessings, life lessons, love, forgiveness, and asking for forgiveness. So I really like this. I think it goes along with a lot of the work we're talking about. There's that link for the values history form, and again, I'm going to make sure that you guys have access to that. And I had mentioned throughout this the Family Caregiver Alliance, and that's their website, caregiver.org, and they are the best source for professionals and lay public as well. And I know I talk really fast, but I had to cover all this. So that's it. And now I'll take questions.
Thank you very much. Don, if you can get her, make sure she has your email to get this information. We can put it on the church website. That'd be a good idea. Okay. Any questions for Dr. Black?
What surprised people most about what I talked about here tonight?
Thanks.
What surprised you the most?
So few people are actually planning.
Yeah. Yeah, that definitely was. I was just curious from the audience side. I've been working with this for so long.
Just outlining all of these subcomponents, issues, it's mind-boggling. So what we need is to be able to look at this again.
Yeah, it's overwhelming. We have a fragmented system of care, and it's absolutely overwhelming. And this is a group here who's very involved and very able to do things. Think about so many people who are unable, and a lot of people need some help.
Hi. Not sure I heard you correctly, so I wanted to ask you. Did you say that if we don't make decisions that and we're in a certain state of health that our insurer could make decisions?
No, not insurer. But in the healthcare setting, you know, they're always going to rely on pretty much on the side of life. And so you could be kept alive in conditions that you don't want to be. I mean, most people don't want to be hooked up in an ICU bed when there's no chance of recovery. That's not how they want to spend their last days, and that's what will happen if you don't talk about what you want. I mean, it was around the 1980s. It, you know, turn of the century, most people died at home. Around the 1980s, it was something like 80-some percent died in the hospital setting. Now, some people died in roadways, right? And they died in accidents throughout the country, you know, in their homes and things like that. So about 80%, though, did die in the hospital setting. And that number has gone down to in the 70s now, largely because of hospice and people being able to die at home. But most people want to do that. And I'm telling you, if you don't start thinking about how you're going to make that possible, it may not happen for you.
here. I just finished a 4-month healthcare surrogate stint. Very important thing to realize is that after the first 5 or 6 days, when I did make decisions, give blood, don't give blood surgery, then you need to be a friend. So whoever you choose has to also be a friend, because now he was alive, he was going to live, but he couldn't do his checking, he couldn't take care of his cat, he couldn't obviously drive. So when you choose your healthcare surrogate, make sure it's a person who's going to go beyond making that decision.
Well, you know, they're legally, you know, they're signing up to be just the healthcare surrogate.
Right.
But as you're saying, and as we're saying, everything is so intertwined with all these other aspects.
A friend of mine is a nurse who worked in a nursing home and was appalled by what she observed. The number of people kept on life support, ventilators, et cetera, because the nursing home made a lot of money
Let me tell you a story there. You know, again, you could end up on a ventilator from a minor surgery. If you have underlying lung disease, COPD, emphysema, there's going to be problems getting you off of the ventilator in some cases. And if they can't wean you off, you may become long-term vent dependent. And I have seen families, and remember, that is artificial respiration. Legally, medically, ethically, you do not have to have that, and you can have said that. But what happens, and I've seen families do this, they opt to have the people kept on because they don't want to make the decision, and you know, it's not framed that they're honoring what the person wanted. It's framed that I'm pulling the plug. That's how they're reading it. But instead, what they need to view it as, this is artificial respiration, and he didn't want it. But that's not what they're thinking. They're thinking, I'm pulling the plug. And what happens in long-term respiration, only so many facilities provide that. It's very expensive, over $100,000 a year. And your relative may end up located hundreds of miles away from you. You're never even going to be able to see them. But now that's the decision that's made, because with withdrawal of that support, which is legally, medically, ethically justified, was not done.
I happen to have had a very extensive tour of Sarasota's Fire Station Number 1 last night, and I can tell you that they are very proactive in keeping you alive.
Oh, yeah.
And
that's their business.
You almost have to maybe wear a bracelet or something like that, and
I shared with you the pulsed form will probably be coming to the state. There's efforts now to get it to Florida. It's been successful in a few other states. New York has the most form. It's basically physician's orders on life-sustaining, and it's a community document so that when they come out, if they're called, they're going to respect what people would want because the decision has been made.
To what degree were your results affected by income level or asset ownership of the people you viewed?
Well, you know, again, we looked at income as a factor, and what we found was that those people were more likely to plan financially, and they were more likely to have a last will, and it made sense because they've got money to send off to the next generation, and they've got planning to do. So that's the only thing that we found.
How detailed can a will be? I mean, this gentleman talked about cats and all kinds of the disposition of everything you have, and also,
you know, that's a legal question that you want to go to an attorney with. But some of the interesting things that I found out on that, I have to tell you because I teach a death and dying class, was that you do want to identify people and give them a nominal amount, a dollar, or explicitly mention them, because if they're not mentioned, they can contest it. They can contest it. So by mentioning them and giving them a nominal amount, it shows that you explicitly thought about them. Yeah, I did. Yeah, I thought that was very interesting. So did we all. You know, there's a difference between some of the things we're talking about, though, because the last will is only going to take effect, in being executor, is only going to take effect after you're dead. A lot of what I'm talking about here was before that. Planning for it, but before that.
Could you
Could you repeat what you said about the ER being called? If you don't want to be resuscitated, how can one avoid having that happen?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the best thing to do is don't enter into the medical emergency response system. Because they are in the business of saving lives, and that's exactly what they're going to do, and they're very good at it. And the environment of technology, of what they have to keep people alive long after a natural death would ensue, is endless. They always have something to offer. And these are, you know, we're really now raising issues for incredible healthcare costs ready to explode that really are going to need to be talked about. You know, one of the things that just happened, and this had nothing to do with the economics, but this just happened about a month ago, was the changes to kidney donation. The way the system worked was the longer you were on the list. You know, we have thousands of people dying a day waiting for organs. You know that, right? And so we are really doing a lousy job in organ donation. And the system favors older people because whose name is on the list longest. And what they're doing now is saying, wait a minute, we're giving a kidney that has a 30-year lifespan to somebody who's got a 10-year lifespan, and it's not right. And so other ethical principles such as justice are becoming, it's not just autonomy and beneficence, it's also principles of justice now. And you're going to see much more of that in the coming years. I know it.
In Florida, there's a yellow form that your doctor, in answer to your question, the doctor and you sign it. It should be posted on your refrigerator, yeah. And the emergency people are required by law to look there first,
right,
to see if it's
right
there.
It's a community. It's a community DNR.
It's got to be the yellow one, though.
Yeah, it has to be a special form, and, you know, some people keep it in a file or vial in there. But I'll tell you, you'd be surprised. Well, it's not, the paramedics probably don't ignore it, but a lot of things are happening very quickly, and you'd be surprised. People panic, a whole bunch of things happen, and it doesn't always play out the way people want. And then you find yourself in a high-tech environment that you didn't want to be in.
I just would love to share just for a minute something that we did when my mother, my dad had died in his sleep. My mother said she was so happy he went, because if he didn't go pretty soon, she was going to go. I mean, he was a problem at the end of his life. Anyway, we had a sense of humor in our family. But when we observed that my mother could not really take care of herself at home, my sister called and she said, I don't know, we have to do this. We have to put her in a nursing home. And I said, okay, on one condition. That we each, of course we live close by, that we each take one day a week the rest of her life. My mother was so happy in that nursing home. She saw us more often than she had seen us for years. We followed through with our plan. The nursing staff was on top of everything because we were there when we observed a little problem. Mm-hmm. And whatever we do, I pass that along to everybody, because the whole family needs to be included, yeah. And can make a huge difference.
I love that your family was obviously a very strong, healthy family working together. A lot of families do put equitable arrangements into place, but I'm telling you, what also plays out is, she was always your favorite, you do it. You know, and all kinds of things come out, okay? All kinds of things come out.
Okay, any more questions? Oh, thank you very much, Professor Blasky. Really appreciate it.
Can I take that out now?
Very helpful.
Oh, I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Very helpful for me. I'm a service coordinator in a HUD facility.